This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You are almost certainly aware of the Earth's magnetic field. It's what makes the compass point north. It helps animals navigate home and protects the upper atmosphere from harmful radiation. But the moon used to have an atmosphere too, and scientists still aren't sure what killed it or even what started it in the first place. But new research published in Science Advances this week gives us at least one new piece of information, and that is the moon's magnetic field lasted at least 2 billion years, a long time for such a small piece of rock. Here to explain is my guest, Sonia Taku, an assistant professor of planetary science at Rutgers University and co-author of the new research. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks.
Do we know how the moon got a magnetic field to begin with?
Well, within terrestrial or rocky planets, magnetic fields are generated by the churning of liquid metal within the cores of these planets. So basically, there has to be some mechanism that's causing motion and churning of that liquid metal.
I said atmosphere before. Of course, I meant magnetic field. Sorry about that.
No worries.
So do we have any idea why it lost its magnetosphere?
Well, generally, the convection or the motion of liquid metal within the cores is tied to the cooling of the planet. So you have hot metal rising within the core and cold metal falling as it cools off closer to the mantle. And so the idea is that on a smaller planetary body like the moon might cool off more quickly than, say, a larger body like the Earth, and that it might run out of energy earlier. And so perhaps the moon's magnetic field turning off has to do with it running out of the power source.
Mm-hmm. So as it cooled down, it lost the ability to make the magnetism.
Probably.
Yeah. And we know all of this from Apollo samples taken from visits to the moon?
We know much of this from Apollo samples. So during the Apollo era, the astronauts collected hundreds of lunar samples from the lunar surface. And scientists, kind of like the earlier generation of what I do, they started to take rocks from the moon and measure them in magnetometers. And they found that many moon rocks were magnetized. But the origin of that magnetization was unclear at first. But more recently, we've been able to do more sophisticated experiments and tests to establish that that magnetism in many cases came from an internally generated magnetic field. And it's not just the samples, but there's also spacecraft that orbited around the moon that have measured ancient magnetic fields preserved in the crust.
That's interesting. I'm curious about how do you find an ancient magnetic field in a rock sample?
Well, so whenever rocks form, they create minerals within the rocks that are like little compass needles, and these minerals align with whatever ambient magnetic field is around at the time that the rock is forming. And as the rock cools down, it freezes in that magnetic direction, and there's also some intensity information that is preserved too. So what we can do is we can take the rock samples and measure them in a magnetometer and get the direction and intensity of the magnetic field in the rock, and then we can convert that to information about how strong the ancient magnetic field was that magnetized the rock initially.
Yeah. Your work was using just one sample from Apollo 15. What made this rock so helpful?
Yeah, so in this particular paper, we only studied one sample. What was special about this rock was in previous studies, we learned that many lunar rocks were non-ideal magnetic recorders. They have iron-nickel alloys, which are the magnetic carrying grains. And sometimes if those grains are too big, and that can happen in more crystalline rocks like basalts from lava flows, but in rocks that cooled more quickly, like this impact, this rock formed via a meteorite impact. It melted a bunch of rocks on the lunar surface and created a glass. And this glass had these beautiful small magnetic grains, which were excellent magnetic recorders. And so this was like the best sample we could have targeted, basically, because it was the best recorder that we'd identified at that time so far.
If you were an astronaut on the moon, would you know this was an important rock to pick up and take home by looking at it?
Now we would, but
who picked it up? Do you know which astronaut picked it up? Is there a record of which?
I don't know exactly which one. I know the Apollo 15 commander was Dave Scott.
Right.
He's a cool guy. I actually got to meet him once, but I don't know who's picked up the specific one.
So what makes this question about the origin of the moon and its magnetic field such an interesting question?
Yeah, so I mentioned that on larger planetary bodies like the Earth and Mercury and, say, one of Jupiter's moons, Ganymede, you can have long-lived magnetic fields that still exist today. And we know that some planetesimals, like asteroids, in the past, at the beginning of the solar system, also had ancient fields that probably died off very quickly. But the moon fell in this really interesting intermediate size range between a body that we know has very long-lived magnetic fields and very tiny bodies where the fields would have dissipated quickly. So the moon was just like a really cool natural laboratory to study intermediate-sized planetary bodies. Mm-hmm. And that in turn tells us about what mechanisms can generate magnetic fields or what the power sources are within these intermediate-sized bodies. Because there might have to be something else just supplementing just the pure cooling of the body.
Mm-hmm. Now, we know that that Mars does not have an atmosphere and because it lost its magnetic field, too. And would that be helped by understanding what happened to the moon, to understand what happened on Mars?
Yeah, so to clarify a little bit, Mars still has a very thin atmosphere that is primarily carbon dioxide, but we know that in the past Mars had a thicker atmosphere and that there was also a lot of water on Mars, so there were lakes and seas potentially. And we think because Mars lost its magnetic field, it lost its shield and the solar wind was able to strip away much of the water from the atmosphere of Mars and leave it barren. We're still not sure exactly why Mars's magnetic field turned off. There have been a variety of hypotheses about that, but one thing that is out there is just potentially the cooling hit a certain point where the generation of the magnetic field was not feasible anymore, and that is one lesson that maybe the moon can also inform us about.
Mm-hmm. Now we know that the solar system is made of a lot of rocky inner planets and not a gassy outer planets. Are we the only rocky inner planet that has a hot magnetic field?
Actually, Mercury has a magnetic field that's generated by fluid motions in its core. But a mystery about Mercury is actually that its magnetic field is surprisingly weak given the size of its core and the size of the planet. And so that's another problem people are working on.
Mm-hmm. So there's a relationship possibly about the size of a body and its magnetic field?
It has to do a little bit with the size of the core of the body. There's a formula. It's like a scaling law. But generally, yeah, there is supposed to be some kind of relationship.
Well, so what do you want to know next? What's next to find out about the changing magnetic fields either on the moon or any other place? What would you really like to know?
What I'd like to know is, right now, before this study, we'd shown that the moon had a magnetic field till 3.56 billion years ago. This study, we extend that lifetime to at least 2.5, but we just studied one rock, and there's a billion-year age gap between 3.5 and 2.5, and then we have, after this rock, we don't know when the moon's magnetic field turned off. So there's a lot more work to do in terms of figuring out exactly when the magnetic field ceased. There's a lot of work to do in figuring out how the field declined, because early on in lunar history, we think the field was as strong as the Earth's field is today, about 50 microtesla. And the field we retrieved in this rock is about a factor 10, 5 microtesla, lower than that. So we really need to learn more about the decline, what could have caused the decline, and whether that means something about different power sources operating in the moon at different times in its history.
Could it tell us anything about the Earth? And are we headed toward a decline ourselves?
Well, the Earth's magnetic field is, you know, generally generated by convection in our core, but also it's supplemented by energy released during the crystallization or the solidification of the solid inner core. And so we think that that process might have also been occurring within the moon. The Earth's magnetic field will probably, you know, turn off at some point, but it's not scheduled to turn off for billions of years from now. And it's sort of in competition with the end of the solar system in terms of time scales when the sun expands and envelops us anyway. So
you'll get back to us on that one.
Yeah, we'll have to get back to you.
This is fascinating. I mean, should we go back and collect more rocks from the moon? And would you learn anything if we got more rocks?
Oh, I would absolutely love it if we collected more rocks from the moon. All the Apollo missions collected rocks from a relatively limited set of regions on the near side of the moon that faces us close to the equator. And there's a lot of rocks that are missing. There's a lot of rock ages that are missing from the Apollo sample suite. And in order to really learn about the moon's history, we have to fill in a lot of these gaps, both in terms of rock types as well as rock ages.
Could we send a rover instead of collecting it there, bringing it back? We send like we do on Mars. Could we send a rover to figure that out?
We could absolutely send a rover to, we could send multiple rovers to the moon or little hoppers that could collect samples or even do in situ analyses on the moon itself. That would be great.
Okay, I'm going to put you down for saying we should send rovers to the moon. How about that?
You can quote me on that.
Okay.
I would love it.
Okay, Sonia Taku is Assistant Professor of Planetary Science at Rutgers University. I hope you get your wish.
So, me too.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Thank you.
You're welcome. After the break, astrophysicist Mario Livio joins us to ask, why do we ask why? It's a celebration and investigation of curiosity, just like curiosity going to the moon. What about curiosity in general? We'll trace it back, all the way from Richard Feynman to, any kind of person who was curious in the past. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Author Kurt Vonnegut famously wrote, "Tigers gotta hunt, birds gotta fly. Man's gotta sit and wonder why, why?" And indeed, curiosity seems to be a fundamental part of what makes us tick. It's certainly part of what drives scientists to investigate the fundamental nature of the universe and everything in it. We even named a Mars rover for curiosity. But where does it come from? And do we all have the same kind or amount of curiosity? Are we really that much more curious than other animals? And what drives the inquisitive minds of people like Leonardo da Vinci, Richard Feynman, and others who can't seem to stop asking questions about everything they encounter? Astrophysicist Mario Livio is one of those kinds of folks, and he's been wondering about these questions and more, and he's written up his findings in a new book, and he's here to talk about it. Mario Livio is an astrophysicist and author of Why? What Makes Us Curious? Welcome back, Mario.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back.
Nice to have you. We have an excerpt from your book on our website at sciencefriday.com/why. And let me just tell our listeners, they can call on in with questions about curiosity, 844-724-8255. We'll ask them, what do they think makes you or people in general curious? What makes you curious? 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. And of course, you can always tweet us at SciFry. Asking why about curiosity, a bit meta, isn't it, Mario?
Yes. The main reason I, chose this particular word, why, is because this particular question is uniquely human. Other animals are curious, but only humans are, worried and curious about reasons and causes for things. Only humans really ask the question, why? So that's why, I chose this as the title.
And in your book, you focus Leonardo da Vinci and Richard Feynman as examples of spectacular amounts of curiosity. What made you home in on those two?
Well, if you look at Leonardo da Vinci, I tried at first to determine, okay, what was he curious about? And basically what I discovered was that he was curious about everything. I mean, with the possible exception of politics, which, you know, he lived at the time of the Borgias, so anybody who was interested in politics got killed. So it was very wise of him not to be curious about politics. He got funded by the Borgias, but he was really curious about almost everything else, human anatomy, flow of water, all kinds of machines, of course, painting and all that, all the arts, astronomy, you name it. He was curious about it.
Hmm. And Richard Feynman was well known for his curiosity and wrote books about it. He's been interviewed about talking about knowing. You know, I don't understand why people don't want to know things.
That's right. He also once said that, you know, at the basis of all scientific research, there is this curiosity of, you know, wanting to know why things happen. He also said, everything is interesting if you go into it deeply enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Is curiosity something that we're born with? You think some people just more curious about stuff than others?
We definitely are born with it. I mean, there are many studies that have shown that there is a strong genetic component to curiosity. And it is also the case that some people are more curious than others, in the same way that, you know, some people have talents for music and others don't. Some people are smarter than others, things of that nature. So, yes, some people are curious than others. But all people are curious, with, you know, possible exception of people who are very, very deeply depressed or have certain kinds of brain damage.
Hmm. So you can actually see curiosity at work in the brain.
Yes, you can. We couldn't always. I mean, mm-hmm. Some time ago we couldn't do that. But today you actually can take people and put them, you know, through functional MRI, which images the brain. And it images the brain while you make the people curious about something. So, you know, while it doesn't tell you everything, in fact, it tells you very little, it still does tell you which areas of the brain are activated when we are curious.
And are there different kinds of curiosity that you can tell from the brain?
That's right. So there is a curiosity that has been dubbed perceptual curiosity, which is what we feel when we see something that surprises us or, you know, puzzles us, or it doesn't quite agree with what we knew, things like that. And that is felt as a sort of an uneasiness, an unpleasant situation, a bit like a scratch, an itch, sorry, you need to scratch.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there is what has been dubbed epistemic curiosity. That's our love of knowledge, you know, wanting to learn new things, where our brain and our mind assigns value to this knowledge. So that is usually experienced as a pleasurable thing and with an anticipation of reward in the form of what we learn.
Uh-huh. When you study curiosity in the brain and you're scanning people's brains, what do you use to induce their curiosity?
So people have used different methods. So one, in order to induce perceptual curiosity, for example, that thing that is, you know, you feel when you see something ambiguous, they have shown people blurred images of ordinary things, you know, like blurred images of a bus, let's say, and try to make them guess what that is before showing them a clear image. When you try to induce epistemic curiosity, you know, this wanting to know things, they did that mostly by asking trivia questions, you know, like, okay, which musical instrument was invented to sound a bit like a human voice, let's say, which happens to be the violin, by the way. Mm-hmm. So these different techniques to induce different types of curiosity.
Mm. I know you, Richard Feynman is one of my favorite historical figures in science. I've read a lot of his stuff, and one of the things he talks about is about being curious. And he has a debate with some of his artist friends. And I know in the book you talk about his artist friends. And he said, you know, there's a difference between science and art in that as an artist, you may appreciate the color and texture of a flower. But as a scientist, not only can I appreciate the flower for its, you know, obvious looks, but I also can appreciate it for how it works, because I've studied that part of how it works. I'm curious about that side also. And you know, you wonder why, if you're an artist, are you curious about that also?
So, well, Feynman brought this especially as a complaint, in some sense, against artists and writers who somehow, he felt, don't appreciate enough the beauty in science and in the fact that you know something about this. He basically said, the fact that I know some things about how the flower works and what the atoms do, that does not diminish my appreciation of the beauty of the colors. It only enhances it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones because lots of people want to talk about curiosity. Let's take our first call from Bill in Winchester, Virginia. Hi, Bill.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Way back in 1966, when I was a freshman majoring in chemistry, had a brilliant chemistry professor. In his very first lecture, he talked about the word why and how the word why had no place in science. Why was for philosophy and religion. Science was not about why, it was about how, H-O-W. What does your guest think?
I think that he's right in certain sense. The thing is that we almost at this point have sort of confused the two words when we discuss science. I mean, you know, you say, okay, why is the universe expanding? Or you can say, how is it expanding? And, you know, there is room for the two questions. It is true that much of the time science deals with how.
Mm-hmm. You know, there. If you're a very curious person, and a lot of friends who are very curious, you have to put up with ridicule sometimes. For example, I have a friend who's obsessed with construction cranes. You know, we'll stop at a construction site. She'll just look at the cranes working, and people who are with her will say, what are you looking at? She says, I just like the cranes. I like to watch them work. You know, you're nuts. You know? Don't you agree that you people are very curious about stuff? I know I like to stop on the side of the road and look at the rocks. You know, they're just rocks. They're not moving anywhere.
Yes, that's true. But, you know, it is true that different people are curious about different things. There is no doubt about that. And there is nothing wrong with that. In fact, you know, I would argue that you can always use the stuff that people are already curious about to actually drive them to other things that, you know, maybe you think are important for them to be curious about. An example I like to give is that, you know, most children are curious about dinosaurs. They want to hear everything you can tell them about dinosaurs. But, you know, then you can tell them, aha, but dinosaurs also became extinct because of an asteroid that hit mm-hmm. Earth. And then from that, you can get into, you know, the force of gravity. Why did the asteroid hit Earth? Things that maybe originally they weren't that curious about, but you made them curious about through the curiosity they already had.
Well, that brings the age-old question. First, let me remind everybody, I'm talking with Mario Livio, author of Why, What Makes Us Curious. And that is, what happens to kids? They, as you say, they're born sort of scientists. They're curious and want to explore everything. What happens when they grow up?
So what happens is the following. Small children are, they really want to understand cause and effect very early on. I mean, they somehow grasp that every effect is related to some cause. And they want to understand those relations because that helps them really to cope with their environment and to, you know, make fewer errors in their everyday lives. What happens is when we grow up, it's not that we are not curious anymore, but our curiosity somewhat changes from the type that I called perceptual or diversive, which is, you know, being interested in many things and willingness to take risks, even for novelty, more towards the epistemic curiosity, the love of knowledge. So the love of knowledge stays with us actually throughout every time. I mean, mm-hmm. all ages. I mean, even when you're very old, people still are what somebody called infovores, want to devour information. It's just that, you know, that willingness to take risks for novelty is definitely declining.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Carmen in Clear Lake City, Texas. Hi, Carmen.
Hello. My question is there an evolutionary purpose to curiosity?
Thank you, absolutely. Of course there is. I mean, you know, people had to be curious about what happens around them, or, you know, or they just wouldn't know to survive. You know, people also had to know what happens when you walk off a cliff, because if you do that too often, I mean, it's not going to have a good ending.
That's self-selecting, so, that evolution.
Right. So curiosity for sure evolved because of evolutionary pressure. The interesting thing, and, you know, one of the things that we still don't even have, I mean, all the researchers still don't have an answer to, is that we as humans seem to be much more curious than what is, you know, just necessary for survival. Understanding quantum mechanics is very important for advances in physics, and one day surely becomes very, very applicable. But when it starts as a basic curiosity and not one that has immediate applications. Mm. I mean, all science at the end, I like this phrase which says there is applied research and not yet applied research. All research eventually becomes applied.
Talking with Mario Livio, author of Why? What Makes Us Curious, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Number 844-724-8255. Let's go back to the phones because people are curious. Hi, let's go to Megan in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just have two quick comments. One, I have insatiable curiosity, and I blame it on the fact that when I was born, lightning struck, and my mom went into labor, and I came out asking, "What in the Sam Hill was that?" You know. So I've always been curious. But really, when I was in college, I was studying to become a physicist, and I had to give that up because I kept asking, "Why and how is the math the way it is?" So curiosity became a detriment in a way. But I understand the mechanics of physics, but the math just really got me.
Mario, give her some advice.
Yes. I mean, you know, unfortunately, not everybody is talented at mathematics in the same way that not everybody is talented in composing music like Mozart. I think that to some extent, this is associated also with the type of education or teaching that you had at the lower levels of school, because very often things we are really interested in or try to be curious about are affected by the quality of our teachers. So, maybe in your case, you just weren't fortunate enough to have a very good math teacher in high school or even elementary school.
Well, in my case, sometimes I'm just not smart enough. You know, but it doesn't make me less curious, and it doesn't stop me from trying to find out.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, there may be an inability to understand certain concepts, but curiosity can be so strong, right, that you just keep you keep plugging away at it.
Well, look, let me go back to Leonardo. Leonardo was very weak in mathematics. And that, you know, didn't stop him from being the genius that he was. Feynman, on the other hand, in spite of the fact that he studied art and studied drawing in particular, he became, you know, a decent drawer or draftsperson, but he was never Leonardo when it came to art. So, you know, we have different talents.
Mm-hmm. Does it help you cope with the world at all, being a curious person?
Oh, absolutely. In many, many ways. I mean, one thing which I in particular advertise in the book, and which I coined even a phrase for this, although I discovered later that I'm not the first to have thought of that, which is curiosity is the best remedy for fear. And I strongly believe in that. You see, very often we are afraid of things that we don't know much about or we don't understand. And if we become curious about them and learn more about them, then we are much less afraid.
Interesting. We're going to take a break, come back, and finish up talking with Mario Livio, Why? What Makes Us Curious? His new book. You will be curious to read it, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about curiosity, why we possess it, maybe how to foster it, with astrophysicist and author Mario Livio. His new book is Why? What Makes Us Curious? It was out this summer. And before the break, we were talking about curiosity and fear. And let me pick up on that theme, because there are a few phone calls and tweets about that. Let me take a phone call from Joshua in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. To follow up on his last point, I was curious if you think the purpose of curiosity is actually to control our feelings of anxiety and kind of ultimately our fear of death. You had said that it seems like we have an almost outsized curiosity that goes beyond our needs for safety. But I'm wondering if you think that that reflects our bottomless well of anxiety over life in general, maybe.
Hmm.
I think that surely there is a component of that, but it surely cannot, you know, relieve all of our anxiety because, for example, that perceptual curiosity, that thing that feels like an itch we need to scratch, in itself generates a certain amount of anxiety. It's a different type of anxiety, but still some anxiety in the sense that, you know, think about this when you're trying to remember who was the author who wrote, you know, The Old Man and the Sea. And sometimes that can really bother you for a few hours. Of course, today we can address that very quickly using Google. But it's so it then generates its own some type of anxiety. But I agree with you that it can definitely relieve the type of anxiety that we feel because of things that are unknown or misunderstood.
But there's also the dark side to curiosity. For example, many people have tweeted, Sydney's tweeted, did it really kill the cat? I mean, you're associating it with something not to do. Don't do it, right?
Yes. I am very much against that that particular phrase. And it also, by the way, has a rejoinder, which is, but satisfaction brought it back. So
Schrodinger's cat. Must have.
So the thing is, you see, if you look throughout history, there have been entire periods where either oppressive regimes or various types of ideologies tried to build walls around certain types of knowledge and say, okay, you shouldn't be curious about that because this is not good for you. I very much object to that. I think that we should be curious. Of course, there are things that, you know, there is a sort of bad side of curiosity, which is, you know, you shouldn't eavesdrop on, you know, what your neighbors are talking or things of that, or the NSA shouldn't listen on our phone calls. This is, I'm talking about the good type of curiosity, the one that, you know, teaches you, the love of knowledge, all that type of stuff. And for that, we should object to the attempts even to try to suppress our curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can take a call or two in here. Let's go to Julia in Orlando. Hi, Julia.
Hello.
Hey there.
Hi. I'm calling to ask whether greater access to information has somehow affected curiosity, where in the olden days we'd have to go find the answer to something in the Encyclopedia Britannica or call the library or something, and now we can answer our questions in a moment by using Google or another search.
That's a great question. Great question. Very.
Yeah, it's an important one too, because it's really a cultural change. So there is one type of curiosity that I haven't mentioned yet, which is specific curiosity. That is, you know, when you need a very specific piece of information, you know, like who said we're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars, which happens to be Oscar Wilde. So to answer those questions, the internet is, of course, fantastic, and it relieves us of that specific type of curiosity very, very quickly. However, please note that, you know, what we do when we do scientific research or big artistic projects, we're trying to look for answers for questions to which we don't know the answers yet. And that means that we cannot find those answers on the internet. Mm. So what I think happened is that the technology has allowed us to get rid of those immediate specific curiosity types of things, but it still allows us to continue to be epistemically very, very curious.
Do you feel sorry for people who are not really very curious like you are?
I don't know if I feel sorry for them because, I mean, different people have different types of qualities.
But there's an enjoyment. I mean, I can hear in your voice, and I know in my own life, there's an enjoyment about being curious that people may not
share. I agree. But as I said, most people are curious about something. I mean, their level of curiosity may be somewhat different. But, you gave that story about your friend of yours that she's very interested in cranes and things. So, you know, she may be extremely curious about cranes. So, you know, you don't find that particularly interesting, but obviously she does.
Yeah, well, somebody else might be extremely curious about Nietzsche or some, you know, a philosopher or something like that. And I don't find that interesting, but I find it's interesting that you may be curious, that it's good to be curious about something.
I agree.
You know, I because I'm very curious about stuff. I can understand other people being geeky about other things that I'm not geeky about, you know, but I understand where they're coming from.
Look, the only reason I ended up, you know, doing all this research on curiosity and writing this book is because I became extremely curious about curiosity and how it works.
Well, and it's a great book. Like all your books, Mario, I want to recommend it to everybody. It's called Why? What Makes Us Curious? By great astrophysicist and a great popularizer of science, Mario Livio. And you can read an excerpt from his book on our website at sciencefriday.com/why. Thank you, Mario. Thanks for taking
Thank
time.
You.
It's always fun, as always. We'll have you
My
back.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. Okay, you have 10 days and counting to prepare for the solar eclipse, but if you can't make it to the path of totality in time, don't worry, you won't be left out of the fun. A group of students and scientists is working to capture images and hopefully live streaming the eclipse from a unique vantage point, a balloon, thousands of feet up there, up and away, and conducting a bit of science too. My next guests are part of that team. Angela Desjardins, I'll get it, is the leader of the NASA Eclipse Balloon Project. She's also assistant research professor in physics at Montana State University in Bozeman. Welcome to Science Friday, Angela.
Thank you very much.
And it's Desjardins, correct?
It's actually Desjardins.
Desjardins, just like the French.
It's French. It's a French-Canadian name.
I would have said Desjardins.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. There you go.
Levi Wilmeth is a computer science student at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. He's a member of the Oregon State and Lynn Benton Community College Eclipse Ballooning Team. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Angela, there's so many different projects happening for the eclipse. Why did you choose balloons? You know, what can we learn from that vantage point?
The really great thing about balloons, so these balloons we're talking about are not what you would imagine as hot air balloons or party balloons. These are special balloons that actually go to the edge of space, so up to about 100,000 feet. And from that vantage point, you can actually see the curvature of the Earth and the blackness of space. It really looks like you're looking down on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so the idea came about because I knew there were lots of student high-altitude ballooning groups around the country, and that it would be really a very special viewpoint to be able to do this. And then the next exciting thing that came up was, sure, it'll be great to be able to capture that footage, but what if we can do it live while we have everybody's attention during this amazing moment on eclipse day? Then that would be truly special.
Mm-hmm. And Levi, you're on one of these teams and you're working to capture images from a boat offshore. What do you hope to capture there?
That's correct. So we at Oregon State University are in kind of a unique position that we're on one of the coastlines. So what we're hoping to do is launch our balloon from just off the coast of Oregon and get that first shot of the shadow as it kind of hits the continental U.S. And I think that'll kind of be a unique image and hopefully a really nice video for people that can't be there in person.
Give me an idea of what you have to build to get your balloon and payload together.
So there's quite a bit that goes into it. Angela and the team at Montana State University did a great job putting together kind of a beginning package for people to kind of build and expand on, including some equipment for making that initial networking connection between the balloon and the ground itself that would allow us to send the video back and forth. And one of the challenges that we've kind of faced along the way is kind of getting that link as good as it can possibly be by pointing the dish just as accurately as we can.
That raises in me. I was thinking about your project. There's a camera on the balloon going.
That's
up.
Correct.
How do you keep it pointed while it's floating around and keep it pointed in the right direction?
Yeah, so this is one of the really tricky things about the project. So one of the main ways we do that is we actually have an Iridium satellite modem on board the balloons, which has a GPS signal. So we actually have a system that takes that GPS signal from the Iridium satellite and enables the ground station dishes to be able to point to the balloon. And this is, you know, one of the really great projects that makes it really tricky. Actually, it's amazing. So we have this little shoebox-sized thing floating, you know, way up in the air at the edge of space, and it's beaming down a signal to an 18-inch dish on the ground.
Yeah.
And that we're able to actually get any footage at all is really an amazing technological feat. Several key technologies had to come together in order for us to even be able to do this.
And how do you keep the camera pointed where you want to, I imagine, which is at the eclipse?
So each of the teams has kind of solved this in different ways. Personally, what we've done is we've tied the camera itself to our payload, which is tied to the neck of the balloon, so that as the balloon itself mm-hmm. gets quite large, it has a large amount of inertia that kind of holds it in place. And in order for that camera to sway around, this gigantic balloon has to also sway. And we found that really helps kind of dampen all the small motions of wind that you might kind of encounter along the way. Plus, as it gets really high, the air becomes very thin and everything kind of really settles out once you get up to the top there.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I want to get a few more questions in, but I'm still trying to noodle because I'm not that smart. How do you keep the camera pointed in a floating balloon at the moon, at the sun? You know?
Ah.
So actually, let me just kind of interject here really quick. And, you know, that's the first reaction is that, you know, with these balloons, we actually want to look at the sun. But if you think about, you know, any time you might actually want to point your camera toward the sun, it totally saturates your image.
Right.
And so actually, you know, for most teams, looking at the sun is not what we want to do. The thing that's amazing from this vantage point is actually the shadow. So looking down on the Earth as a planet and seeing that shadow come across the Earth is really a profound, amazing thing to look at. Now, that's not to say some teams are going to choose to look at the sun. You know, I myself have an infrared solar experiment that's going to really want to look at the sun. But for most teams, the balloon is going to move around. There is some, you know, pointing capability in some cases. But for the most part, it's going to move around. And you're going to see from that high, you can see 200 miles in every direction. So you can actually see the shadow coming across the Earth for about 10 minutes before it's actually totality where the balloon is, and then and 10 minutes going.
All right.
So it's really...
You got my attention.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's amazing.
And is there real science to be learned there, Angela?
There is some really fantastic science. There's really three key pieces of science that we're doing here. So there's a sister project in addition to this streaming live video that we're actually going to look at how the eclipse shadow actually affects the atmosphere. And so every day, you know, we have the sunrise and sunset, and that sets up gravity waves, so turbulence basically in the atmosphere, gentle waves. But we know the eclipse is actually going to set up much stronger turbulence in the atmosphere. And we're actually going to use this eclipse to learn more about the atmosphere itself by studying exactly what happens with the eclipse shadow. So that's one piece. We actually have a partnership with NASA Ames to fly some resilient bacteria on many of the balloons. And the question here is, so actually in the upper atmosphere, the temperature and pressure is very similar to that of the surface of Mars. So we want to be able to ask the question, how clean do the spacecraft have to be when we send them to other planets? And this is something that this team at NASA Ames has been looking at in detail. Obviously, we want to make sure we're not bringing any Earth organisms to another planet and contaminating it. And so we're bringing this organism that we think might actually flourish in Martian-like conditions. And so we can test that in the upper atmosphere. And during the eclipse, actually, the amount of sunlight is similar to that on the surface of Mars. So it's a really great chance to, on a whole bunch of balloons, get this other really interesting piece of space biology data. And then the final piece is sending all of our data with a project sponsored by Google called the Eclipse Mega Movie Project. And here they're actually taking the very last little moments of light called Bailey's beads and taking lots and lots of images to examine that exactly to be able to look at the exact surface of the sun. So the exact size of the sun and exactly what's going on the surface of the sun, which you can only do during a total solar eclipse.
Levi, you can see Dr. Desjardins is not excited at all about this, about this project. What excites you most about it?
So our team shares her enthusiasm a lot. We've met with Angela at Montana State there, and she is contagiously enthusiastic about it, which is great. For us, our team spent a good portion of the year sort of developing the ship station piece of it. We kind of started with a system that could kind of point from the shore, but we also needed to develop a system that could handle the motion of the ship, kind of rolling with the waves, the actual movement of the ship. And so we spent a good part of our year kind of developing that system as opposed to a scientific payload as well.
Well, we have all kinds of links on our website. This is exciting. It's very exciting to hear about this. And people can read more about the balloon project and other experiments at our website at sciencefriday.com/balloon. Wish I had more time to talk about the tides with you, Dr. Desjardins, but we'll have to wait for another time because the moon and sun aligning. Something's going to happen. Dr. Desjardins is leader of the NASA Eclipse Ballooning Project, assistant research professor in physics at Montana State University in Bozeman. And Levi Wilmoth is a computer science student at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners, studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. It's going to be Eclipse Week coming up in 10 days. We're excited. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.